superior news and issues from a superior point of view.
Lily blows her horn to ask the bridge to lift.
Her work earns praise in the New York Times and fills the shelves of our local bookstores.
But a big oar boat blasts its horn much louder. The bridge
we'll catch up with Margie Price. But first,
the setting sun pancakes into the clouds, orange and pink.
With virtually no other human around, an experienced hiker explores Isle Royale.
What a perfect sight I have.
We'll hear the chronicle of the blissful hiker. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Isle Royale is the largest island in the largest lake in the world. But if you're looking for people who live there full-time, you won't find any. There are about a dozen wolves, a couple thousand moose, and weather permitting, a hiker or two exploring its inlets and trails. One of those is Allison Young, whose story about how she became a hiker, logging 12,000 miles across six continents, is as interesting as the places she's explored. She's a former concert flutist, or flautist, and I'm going to let her decide which one she prefers, with major orchestras. Then she became a classical music radio host before her current avocation as she calls herself, the blissful hiker. And she joins me now. Welcome to Simply Superior, Allison Young.
Thank you so much, Robin. It's great to be here.
So is it flutist or flautist?
I think, is it Isle Royale or is it Isle Royale?
You know what? We'll go with whatever sounds comfortable at the time coming out of our mouths.
That's about the same with flutist or flautist. There's a great joke about that. Flautist are for those who say tomato.
And flutist?
And flutist are for those who say tomato. So, right. So
I think there's a song in there.
There's a song in there.
All right. I won't flout my ignorance on that. So you played with some pretty major orchestral outfits, such as the Boston Symphony Orchestra, and you had to be pretty good to get into that.
Yes, I was pretty good. So I had a full career as a professional musician, and about 20 years ago, I developed a neurological condition that's called dystonia. It's a kind of puzzling and baffling issue, a neurological very similar to like Parkinson's or essential tremor. And it affected my hands to the point that I couldn't play at the level that was required to play in a Boston Symphony Orchestra or Atlanta Symphony Orchestra. So I really needed to leave that piece of my career and find something else to do. It was a difficult time, as you can imagine. I mean, losing something that's, it's not really just like your identity or, you know, your source of income, but it's kind of your sense of purpose. So that was a difficult time. And actually, it's interesting because the trail has always been a place I've gone to. Nature, walking outdoors, has always been a place that grounded me, a place that helped me kind of get more in conversation with the spirit. So anyway, I did some major hikes. I mean, I walked backpacked solo in Texas, out in Guadalupe and in Big Bend. And I realized that like letting go and seeing what was going to be open to me next was like a really valuable thing to be willing to do, to sort of quit. And what I opened to, interestingly enough, was a position like what you have. I became a radio host. Kind of fell into that, but found that to be a really easy and interesting transition to host classical music. And I was in Houston, Texas for a couple of years, and then I came up here to St. Paul and worked at American Public Media and Minnesota Public Radio. And that was like a really, really cool time. But through all of this, I was always kind of returning to, you know, to the trail, to the outdoors, to get even more in touch with, you know, sort of the person I am and sort of where I fit in, I guess you could say, in like in the cosmos.
So I know mountaineers climb mountains because they're there. You've been hiking all over the place.
Yeah.
When did that become serious?
Yeah. I mean, it's serious all the way from the start. My earliest memory as a child is walking and looking at my little shoes sort of moving me forward and how like powerful that was. You know, it went on to, you know, wanting to explore. It's a sense of curiosity And, you know, you bring up the idea of a mountain climber and they say because it is there. But the idea is like, why are you going? Well, simply because I want to see and I want to know. I want to know what it is. What can my body, my mind and my spirit experience when I go to this new place? I mean, whether it's something like Isle Royale, which is, you know, close by, is not as difficult of an exploration as something like Everest or some of the other hikes I've done, which have had no trail or have been in foreign countries or have, you know, been filled with a lot of obstacles, you know, then that becomes more heavy on the side of you know, what your body can do and what you can like physically handle.
We're speaking with Allison Young. She's a classical flutist or flautist turned radio host turned blissful hiker. She's produced a podcast about her hiking on Isle Royale in the summer of 2020. So yes, it was there you decided to hike it and you went to the island. Now, what did you know about the island, by the way, before you got there? You looked at a map, you said you thought it was part of Minnesota like everybody does, and you realized it was Michigan. And we've talked about that on this show a lot. At some point, we will tell the whole story of the Toledo War that was between Ohio and whatever, and it ended up in the UP becoming part of Michigan. So anyway, what did you know? And yes, it was there.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting thinking of like all of the places that I had been. You know, just to tell you a little bit more about my podcast, it's called Blissful Hiker, and it's of all of my hikes. So I have, you know, chapters on New Zealand and chapters on the PCT and chapters on Wind River Range, Arizona Trail, a lot of different places I've been. But I have, you know, sort of five different episodes on Isle Royale. And it's always kind of interesting how we skip places that are closest to us. I mean, the island, it's so close, yet it's so far, right? So from St. Paul or from Superior, Wisconsin, I mean, you'd drive up the North Shore, most likely of Minnesota, and get to the island from there, or you could go to the Keweenaw Peninsula. But, you know, all of that is going to require, it requires time to drive. It requires getting a ferry or getting a plane. And it just all seemed like a little bit too much planning or too much requirement to get that kind of time to do it.
And it's not cheap, I understand.
And it's not cheap, right. I spent $366 for a plane flight. It's pretty expensive. So I kind of put it off because it felt so far. I still did, you know, the Superior Hiking Trail. I've hiked a lot of the North Country Trail. I've done the, you know, Kekakabek and the border route. But the island just kind of kept getting out of my grasp. And the year before, I had set these really large goals. I walked all of New Zealand on the Te Araroa, which is it's like the Appalachian Trail of New Zealand. So that took me 5 months. And then I took another 5 months to walk the PCT. So approximately 5,000 miles with other hikes that I added into that as well. And I came home and it was kind of time to take a break, you know. And then the pandemic hit. And it was such a weird time for all of us. It's hard to look back on those very first days of how, you know, we thought we needed to wipe everything down and we thought we couldn't even be outside near people. And then something really weird happened that summer. I mean, not only did COVID hit, but I got this weird pull of a muscle in my inner thigh. And I thought, oh, you know, I've just stepped funny or something. And it was not getting better. My gait started to get weird. Like I couldn't step properly. And during, you know, and I was just kind of walking in state parks. I wasn't doing anything really major, maybe a few overnights, but nothing really major. And a friend of mine said to me, you know, Isle Royale is open right now. And I said, no, I heard that they've closed everything. And he said, well, they're flying planes there. So you could take a plane and you could still backpack. And I thought, you know, that sounds like something I should do right now because it didn't seem really, really big. I'm in pain, but, you know, I'm taking a lot of, we call it vitamin I, you know, ibuprofen. And I could do that. So my husband and I drove up there and he, you know, set me on the little plane. And the first indication that something was seriously wrong with me is, you know, I sort of hopped up onto, because it's a float plane, you know, and I hopped up onto it and I was really wobbly. I mean, I couldn't stand on it. And the pilot just, you know, reached out and grabbed me. And I thought, this is not a good sign at all. So anyway, I took the plane there, but I planned a lot of time. I set aside basically 9 days, two halves of days and 7 in between. And Isle Royale is great because they don't require you to specifically choose where you're going to camp. I mean, they encourage that you have some sort of itinerary and kind of a plan so they know where you're going. And so I had a lot of time to play with. I brought plenty of food because you never know if you can get off the island.
You know, it sort of reminds me of the movie version of Never Cry Wolf, where the bush pilot does exactly what you're talking about and dumps the guy in the middle of nowhere and bye, have a good time.
Oh, I know.
Yeah. How deserted was it?
It's very remote, right? So it's closed. There were no ferries, but people came in private boats. Mm-hmm. So I met a couple of boaters. And, you know, if I was really in trouble, I would, you know, I guess I could get a ride off. I also always carry a Garmin InReach Mini. It's a little GPS. Kind of, it weighs 3 ounces. It's a little tiny piece of gear. And there's several things that you can do with this. I am able to have a two-way, so I can have a conversation with someone. So I can actually tell Richard, my husband, I'm starting my trail, and then he can follow my track. Yeah, and I mean, I can tell him, you know, I'm having a good time, or I really need to leave early, or can you see if there's another flight? Or, you know, there's ways you can communicate. It's life-saving because the most important bit of gear on there is the SOS.
We're speaking with Allison Young. We're talking about her hiking of Isle Royale in the summer of 2020. Tell us what you saw.
It's a pretty exciting and magical place. And so what was happening to me, and I was talking about this pain that I was having, and I later learned that actually what was going on is arthritis through my body, and I was losing all of the cartilage in my hips. And so later that fall, I had both of them replaced. It was pretty serious. So I was walking on, you know, on hips that weren't really working. And what that caused me to do, which I found kind of a gift in a certain way, I couldn't go as fast. I couldn't go as far. So my days were shorter. I mean, I think I had one 15-mile day. So some people would say that's pretty far. But I didn't have these kind of like pushing 20-mile days or really going all day. And so that slowing down, you know, allowed me to appreciate and kind of be a little bit more alert and open to what was happening on the island. And your listeners may know that Isle Royale is has a history. It's the longest running predator prey study in the world. I think it started in the 50s. And no one is exactly certain how the moose got there. There's some argument that they actually swam or they walked across the ice, but they weren't there before 1900. And so once the moose established themselves on the island, the wolves soon followed because they're a source of food. So there's been this interesting intricacy between the wolves and the moose and how they've kept themselves at the right numbers for so long. But also Isle Royale is one of the only places, I think it might be the only place in the world, where wolves and moose live without black bear, because that's like the third piece of this sort of large animal triangle, I guess. I'm not a scientist, but but it's you know, there's no bear there. There are no deer. There are no porcupines.
But there are beavers.
But they're beaver, which, and no one knows exactly how they got there. So like the numbers are, on the mainland, we have 40 species of animals. And on Isle Royale, there's 18 species of animals. And the ranger, Jenna, was the gal I talked to. She said, we are not entirely sure how beaver got here, for instance, or how otter. How did the foxes, these beautiful red foxes, and in a somewhat smallish area, the possibility that you'll see animals is usually greater than it would be if you're hiking something like the Superior Hiking Trail.
Right. And you did see some of the animals.
I did. Yeah. Yes. So when I went out, Jenna told me a couple of things. First, she said, if you see a moose, you use the rule of thumb. You hold your thumb up as you're looking at the moose. And if you can cover it, you know you're far enough away from the moose. And interestingly, moose are far more dangerous than wolves. Wolves have no interest in humans. They don't want to attack you. And all the fairy tales, you know, good, they're great, but that's not really reality. Moose can be very capricious and, you know, quite suddenly run at you. And they're giant. So you have to be quite careful. The safest thing to do is put yourself behind a tree because it's difficult for them to maneuver to you. And just on day two, I saw a giant moose, a bull with, you know, the huge bullwinkle, you know, horn or rack, I guess. And I was, you know, sort of just simply walking on the trail, and I didn't hear a sound. I just had kind of a gut feeling, and I turned to the right, and there he was. Definitely my thumb could not cover him. He was right there. And I was like, ooh, and I started to kind of back up and find a tree. And then I realized he was just kind of standing there. He's sort of chewing his cud. I don't know if they chew cud, but that's what it looked like. And I just, you know, snapped his picture and just very quietly walked past. And that wasn't the first. I think I saw like five or six. I mean, I'd have to look back at my numbers. I saw many on my walk and heard a lot of them, because sometimes they don't want to just stand there. They're a little afraid of you. Mm-hmm. As far as wolves, I saw lots of tracks. I heard them at night. And I was told also by the rangers that they wanted us to try to document where we saw something. So like if you saw something you thought was wolf scat, it's usually fairly obvious because there's hair in it, you know, to take a picture and to, you know, tell them, document it where it was, because they're trying to understand how the wolf population is, you know, separating into packs. And where they are.
So you saw evidence of wolves. I know that you saw a fox.
Definitely.
And you also had an encounter with some aquatic creatures.
Yeah. So, okay. So just really quickly to the foxes, I will tell you that if you're listening to this program to plan your own trip to Isle Royale, you should be certain to carry something to protect your food, because the red foxes are very wily and sly, and they come right in and take your goodies away from you. Sometimes it can even be your shoes. So look out for the foxes, but they're absolutely beautiful. These red foxes with these big bushy tails. They're just gorgeous. I went to Mosky Basin, which is a gorgeous area on the south part of the island. The water's fairly shallow there and it warms up, and I had a really warm, sunny day. So I just kind of started putting my feet in the water and slowly working my body to go in. And it was quite refreshing. I was very, very happy. And I came out and kind of lifted myself onto the rock veranda. And I looked down at my lower legs, and I thought that somehow I got covered in pine needles. You know, I thought, well, maybe they'd fallen into the water and they're stuck on my body. And I tried to brush them off, and they wouldn't come off because they were leeches.
Ew.
It was so gross. Hundreds of leeches, and apparently they come kind of in swarms. And because I was just sitting there, you know, like a beached whale for so long, they had plenty of time to attach. As I tried to pull them off, I mean, I was, you know, you can imagine the sounds coming out of my mouth. I just, you know, I'm grossed out, I'm horrified, I'm screaming. I'm pulling each one off with my fingers, but they attach to my fingers. So the only way to finally get them off was with tweezers, and you know, they're full of blood. It was horrifying, and I was feeling very sorry for myself. And there is a dock there, and it had been damaged, so they closed off the end with this orange plastic, you know, that kind of safety fencing. And all of a sudden I saw a little bit of movement, and I thought, something's at the end of the dock. And I walked out slowly. I was very chastened, so I was moving, you know, very slow and very quietly. And it was an otter, this giant, fat, blubbery otter who'd, you know, hoisted himself up. And he was cleaning. He was doing like his toilette, licking and cleaning and sort of preening his beautiful fur. And I stood there. I mean, I must have been there a half hour, absolutely still. And he kept looking up like he knew something was there, but he couldn't focus on me because I was behind the orange. You know, it's confusing looking. It's orange and it has little holes in it.
He so may he have been tell. Using the rule of otter thumb.
Yes, his otter thumb, exactly. And this thought came into my mind. I thought, how the heck did he get up on this? It's pretty high. And right when I had that thought, another otter hoisted himself right up. He just sort of threw his body in one motion from swimming, and flopped onto the dock also.
Well, I think it speaks to the mystery of the animals there and their abilities that actually lead to how they got there in the first place.
Right.
Again, we're speaking with Allison Young. We're talking about her hiking Isle Royale in the summer of 2020. And you, of course, are producing a podcast about it. You have a little clip for it. Can you set this up for us?
Yes. This is just the very opening of a series of five different episodes from Blissful Hiker podcast where I focus on Isle Royale. So I take my phone with me. I mean, that's basically my computer when I hike, and I certainly take a lot of pictures. I take some video, but I also simply collect the sound in and of itself. So in this particular clip, what I gathered, I'm standing there with my phone, and I'm kind of hanging down off a cliff towards the water on Lake Superior. I'm actually at I'm at Todd Harbor at this point, and the water is very gently coming up onto the rock and going underneath and making this kind of bloop, you know, that kind of bloopy sound. And I'm describing sort of the experience of my first night at Isle Royale.
All right.
The setting sun pancakes into the clouds, orange and pink. Fog that hung over the water this morning and delayed my trip is gone now. Only a memory in washed-out haze on the horizon, fading into the slate-blue cliffs of Canada. A beaver swims towards me, crossing the cove in a half-submerged brown fuzz of determination. He leaves a ripply V-shaped wake in the mostly calm water. The gentle surge as though someone has given just one light tap to the big lake and set it in motion, thumping and fizzing in the crevices beneath me. What a perfect sight I have. A flat tent spot, a board bench for tea in the morning, and this private rock veranda. This is my first night on Isle Royale, at a place out of my way, not in the direction of my hike at all, and really an accidental landing pad. What force set things in motion to create the ideal circumstances to get me here? Whoever, whatever you are, thank you.
And that was a clip from the podcast by the Blissful Hiker, Allison Young, our guest, and her hiking of Isle Royale in the summer of 2020. What was your total mileage? The island is 45 miles long. Did you go the breadth of it or width of it or what?
I did. Yes. Well, I left a lot of time, and sometimes that's really fun. You know, the people go for their FKT, their fastest known time. I tend to go for my SKT, the slowest known time when I'm hiking. And so I left so much time that I was able to hike 90 miles. So there's 145 miles, I think, of trails on the island. So, you know, pretty significant amount of mileage. And you do have to take a lot of food for that many miles.
And you memorialized it for all of us to hear. Where can we hear your podcast?
It's on everywhere you get your podcast. So Apple, the works. It's called Blissful Hiker. And you can listen to my podcast. I also am primarily a speaker, so I give a lot of presentations about what I do. You can go to my website, blissfulhiker.com.
Great. We've been speaking with the Blissful Hiker, Allison Young. She's a classical flutist turned radio host turned Blissful Hiker who's hiked all over the place, but of particular interest to us, Isle Royale in the summer of 2020. Thank you for joining us, Allison.
You bet. Thank you, Robin.
Coming up, author Margie Price shares her two latest works.
How drowsy it had all been. The warm sun pouring through the living room window, the buzz of a fly, the ticking of the clock, the murmur of soft voices.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. The words and literary voice you're hearing should be familiar to anyone who's visited Zenith Books or any other local bookseller as the work of Duluth author Margie Price. And if you come back to those stores a few months later, you'll see more of her work because she's probably written a few new titles since that time. And if your bookstore visits are outside the region, you'll still see her name because she's a perennial national bestseller in a variety of different genres. Two of her latest works are Windswept, a middle grade novel published in September, and Lily Leads the Way, a picture book that came out in May. Her work has been lauded in the New York Times, but you don't need them to tell you how wonderful it is because she's right here to share some of it herself. Welcome to Simply Superior, Margie Price.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that nice introduction.
And of course, it's actually welcome back because you've been on the show a couple of times before, though not recently enough for us to keep up with all you've been producing since then. So how many books have you written?
Oh, I should have known you were going to ask that. Well, I think it's like a baker's dozen at this point.
Okay.
So I didn't start writing, you know, until I was, you know, on in years, mm-hmm. let's say, because I worked with Colder by the Lake and other theater companies for many, many, many years before that. So it wasn't really until my children were almost out of the house that I started writing for young readers.
Oh, so you weren't writing for your own children. No A.A. Milne, Christopher Robin deal going on here.
Well, no, but I think that reading to the kids was an inspiration mm-hmm. for wanting to do that. And I think I started writing or trying to write like picture books and things when the kids were still pretty small. But, you know, it can often take a long, long, long gestation before you really land on something that right. That's the right thing for the publishing world.
And kids are growing through clothes and everything else in life. And so that's not going to wait on a publisher's schedule.
No. Yeah. It'd be very tricky to try to write a story or a book for your child at whatever age they are right at that moment, because it would, by the time that book actually came out. And in the case of picture books, it can take a very long time because you have to, if you're not the illustrator, the publisher has to find an illustrator, get them to agree. They have to put it on their schedule, and then they get a long time to do all the art. Mm-hmm. So it can take years from when you start writing till you see a book.
On the other hand, you are cranking them out as far as I can see. The last time we featured your books, Village of Scoundrels and The Littlest Voyager, and then you had some installments in your Enchanted Lake Mystery series. And some of that was, I think you told us, because of the pandemic, well, what else did you have to do?
Well, those stories were all finished before the pandemic, and little did I know that they would publish right when the world started shutting down. And, you know, actually two of them, The Village of Scoundrels and Littlest Voyageurs, came out at the very beginning of the pandemic, and bookstores were closed, libraries were closed, the publishers sent everyone home. There was just no action. And it was not an ideal time to launch a book, I'll tell you that.
Actually, I recall there was a paper shortage too, right?
And, yeah.
Grover
and printing.
Actually, right.
I mean, everything. Everything got backed up and didn't happen. And yeah, it was a rocky time for book publishing. My books came out. They came out in print and hardcover. And they were out there. Were people aware of it? I don't know. You know, later on, bookstores got real savvy about having virtual launches, and they still often do them because it's kind of nice. You can invite all your friends from the East Coast and the West Coast and overseas, and, you know, people who would normally not attend something like that can actually join in. And so that, I think that's actually been kind of an interesting thing that bookstores have discovered, and libraries too. You know, a lot of virtual events were created, but that didn't happen right when my books came out.
No, nobody figured that stuff out yet, right?
They hadn't figured it out yet, and I didn't know what to do.
We're speaking with Margie Price of Duluth. She's probably the region's most, I'm going to say, prolific author, with her earliest greatest hits being The Peace Bell, Heart of a Samurai, which was a Newbery Honor book. Her two new books are Windswept and Lily Leads the Way. And could we hear an excerpt from one of them?
Sure.
Well, actually, I want to hear an excerpt from each of them, but start with one. It's probably best if you read one at a time.
So. Okay. Well, the picture book, Lily Leads the Way, is about a little sailboat that wants to go out of the harbor into the big lake to see the tall ships that are coming. And she has to go under the lift bridge to do it.
Ah.
Yeah.
No local color here. Yes.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Yes. So as the book says, at the harbor entrance is a bridge that goes up to let ships pass under, then down to let cars go across. Even though Lily is small, her mast is tall, and the bridge must go up to let her pass under. Lily blows her horn to ask the bridge to lift. Me, 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 me. But a big oar boat blasts its horn much louder. Open, open. The bridge answers, okay, okay. The bridge goes up, up, up. Lily hurries toward it. Move aside, the big ship blasts at Lily. I've got a belly full of iron ore, and I can't stop or turn very fast. Better move. Lily scoots away, rocking unsteadily in the big ship's waves. And a 1,000-footer, almost as long as the ship canal, passes under the bridge. Then the bridge goes down, down, down. So Lily confronts many different ships. There's a Salty, there's a Coast Guard cutter, some fishing boats. And all this time, she's trying to get out under the bridge. And then finally, at the very last minute, she slips under the bridge just before it goes down, and here come the ships. Grand old granddaddies and grandmamas, tall ships, big ships with sails of brimming and flags of flying. Lily's sails flutter with excitement as she flutters out to meet them. There's a sloop, a schooner, a brig, a bark, and a barkentine all sailing toward the harbor, silently sailing. No blast of horns, not even a tootily toot. Who will tell the bridge to open? Well, you're going to have to read the book to find out how they get under.
And what grade levels is that? It's a picture book, so.
Yeah. It's, it's for little kids, probably up to about 8 years old or, you know, so six to eight, 4 to 8.
Well, we've all had that experience, some experience on the lift, one way or
right?
the other.
I tell people it's based on a true story because my husband Arno and I used to have a little sailboat. And not anymore, because now you radio the bridge. But in the olden days, you had to literally blow a horn to signal the bridge to ask to lift. And well, and the other thing they do now is a half hour, every half hour. But again, in the olden days, you just had to like blow a horn and hope that they'd hear you and lift the bridge. And we just had this little like, it was like a party horn, really. It kind of went, burp, 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 burp.
Our guest is Marguerite Preuss. She was reading from her book, Lily Leads the Way, a true story, as we are now hearing, and an experience that most of us have had or at least have seen, either trying to get across the bridge or trying to get underneath or whatever. And even though it is an early reader book, around here, those early readers know the names of all those big oar boats that you were just talking about. And they can tell the difference between an oar carrier and a Salty and certainly the tall ships. So,
right. Yeah.
So Windswept, I take it, is a bit different.
Yes. Well, Windswept is for a little bit older kids, about, you know, age 10 and up, although, you know, some younger readers could read it, I'm sure. And it is a fantasy. In this world, children are disappearing, swept away by the wind. And it's a pretty much of a grand adventure interwoven with mostly Norwegian fairy tales involving enchantments, trolls, possibly magic ribbons, and many impossible tasks. Not the least of which is that the protagonists are rescuing their windswept siblings and without getting windswept themselves, of course. So there's a lot in here. It's a hard book to talk about because it's about a lot of things. It concerns climate change and book banning and hope for the future. It's not a dystopia, but it does take place in some future time post-climate catastrophe. Again, not really dystopic because by this time the planet is starting to heal, but the scars are still there. And human nature being what it is, people haven't necessarily evolved to be much different than they are now.
Yeah, we're not very good at that. Yes.
But children, of course, are ever resourceful and resilient and creative and are, as they are now, are hope for the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you share some of that hope for the future in a short excerpt?
Sure. I can read the first chapter. It's entitled An Open Door. How drowsy it had all been, the warm sun pouring through the living room window, the buzz of a fly, the ticking of the clock, the murmur of soft voices. The guard has fallen asleep. That was Lily. Shh, said Rose, the second sister. Take off your crinkly slip, said the third sister, Iris. What, Tag wondered, was happening. She looked up from practicing her ABCs to see the hired guard asleep in a chair and her sisters by the door to the garden, slipping their noisy underskirts out from under their dresses. What are you doing? Tag said. Quiet, Rose whispered. Three sets of fingers went to three sets of lips. Tie your boots, Tagalong, Iris said, pointing to the little girl's feet. Then you can come too. She looked meaningfully at the door. You're going... Shh, all three hissed at their little sister. Tag looked down at her hanging open boots, laces trailing. She crouched to thread the laces around the hooks, a tedious process. When she finally got to the part where you loop the strings into some sort of knot and there's supposed to be a bow made by some mystery of twisty finger magic, she was befuddled. This was the part she had always cajoled one of her sisters into doing for her. Tag looked up, hoping to see a helpful face, but no. There was a swirl of skirts, a blur of movement, whispers, and stocking-footed tiptoeing, then a rush of fresh air as the door to the garden was opened and the skirts rushed out. Her sisters had gone outside. There they were, out there in the garden, feeling the earth under their feet, brushing their hands along the mums, weaving asters into the hair, and skipping under a shower of copper-colored leaves with the autumn-scented air all around them. There was Lily spinning around a slender birch, and Iris twirling with her arms out, and Rose, who with a glance saw Tag running toward the open door and threw her hand up, a warning, "Don't come." And so Tag stopped just at the threshold. Had Rose known? Did she know what was about to happen? Because when Tag saw that hand go up, palm first, and Rose's sweet, kind face, she hesitated. In that moment, a blast of frigid wind blew into the room as if coming for her. As Tag cowered, the wind lifted the curtains, knocked over a lamp, and woke the guard, who leapt up with a, "What the devil?" By the time he had left his chair, a black cloud had swallowed the sun and snowflakes were pouring out of the sky. The garden disappeared in an angry whirl of snow, first the tops of the spruce trees, then their trunks, then suddenly everything was hidden behind a thick white veil. Almost as fast as the storm had appeared, it dissipated. The dark clouds receded, the garden reappeared, the snow melted. Everything was just as it had always been, except Tag's sisters were gone.
And that was an excerpt from Windswept, read by the author, our guest, Margie Preuss. You've got wind in this one, in Other Elements, and the water in Lily Leads the Way. So I'm sensing a pattern here of environmental influences, not to mention squirrel voyagers and things like that. So what wouldn't you write about?
Probably NASCAR racing.
Well, I'm going to hold you to that. I think you might actually do that. After all, you could have a squirrel doing the NASCAR race, right?
Well, I suppose. I live in the North Woods. I have a strong interest in the outdoors. I spend as much time as I can outside. And I think also some of my desire in writing is to encourage young people to spend more time outdoors and to be in the woods and to enjoy the natural world.
And what's on the horizon?
Well, I have a picture book that won't be coming out for a long time, just as we were talking about earlier, because the illustrator can't get to it until 2024. Mm. So don't hold your breath for that one. And that is really the next thing in the pipeline, as far as I know. So I guess I'm going to be home. I'm going to be spending a lot of time outdoors and skiing this winter, I hope. Just hoping there's just a little bit more snow that comes soon, so it's a little bit better. And, just sort of puttering about with some ideas. Nothing major at this point.
But I won't even try to hold you to that, because every time I turn around, I see something new from you. And actually, you do respond, "Well, I hadn't planned on doing that." So you've said that to us before. So.
Oh, okay.
We've been talking to Margie Price. She is, well, I called her before, the undisputed heavyweight champion. I don't know if that's the right analogy of the Duluth Superior book world. And beyond that, her latest books are Windswept and Lily Leads the Way. Thank you for joining us, Margie.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, the regional news and review. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and we're joined by Rick Lubbers of the Duluth News Tribune. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Robin.
Danielle Kading, our Superior-based reporter for WPR News, is not with us in person today, but she filed this report about the fatal accident on Monday of a worker at Fraser Shipyards in Superior. The victim has since been identified as 64-year-old Randall Charles Mulvaney of Watertown, Wisconsin. Here's Danny's report.
Superior Police said the man who died is a 64-year-old Watertown resident. Authorities don't suspect foul play. The U.S. Occupational Health and Safety Administration said the man worked for a Gillette-based sandblasting company. An OSHA spokesperson said initial details show the worker was standing on a railing to pull a tarp before he slipped and fell. The man's death is the second at the shipyard in 5 years. A welder died in 2017 after being severely burned. Federal labor regulators fined Fraser around $12,000 after discovering the man wasn't wearing protective gear. The next year, more than 60 workers reached a $7.5 million settlement with the shipyard for exposure to unsafe lead levels while working on a Great Lakes ship.
And that was WPR's Danielle Kading. So, Rick, there's an agreement between the nurses' union and area hospitals, including in Duluth and Superior, or a tentative agreement anyway.
Yes, it's a tentative agreement, and the hope is that the threatened strike has been averted. Minnesota hospitals, including St. Luke's and Essentia Health, have reached tentative agreements with the Minnesota Nurses Association regarding contract negotiations. Because all hospitals except St. Luke's Lakeview Hospital and Two Harbors reached tentative agreements earlier this week, MNA has called off the strike that was set to begin December 11th. Late in the day on Monday, around 11:30 p.m., St. Luke's issued a statement indicating that the Duluth-based healthcare provider reached a breakthrough in contract negotiations with MNA. Then Essentia on Tuesday morning also stated that a tentative agreement had been reached with MNA nurses, and they agreed to withdraw their strike notice. Twin Port nursing contracts expired June 30, and they had been negotiating for new three-year contracts since March. On December 1st, MNA announced plans for more than 15,000 members to strike against 16 hospitals in Minnesota and Wisconsin unless they could negotiate a contract addressing their pay and staffing concerns. According to MNA, the contracts would include language addressing understaffing and giving nurses a say in how staffing levels are set, which the labor union said they had fought for decades. The contracts vary by hospital system, but include language that requires management and nurses to agree on staff reductions and protect nurses' licenses when they raise concerns about unsafe assignments. Now, nurses in the Twin Ports would receive a 17% pay increase over 3 years, which MNA says is the largest wage increase MNA nurses have won in more than 20 years. Twin Cities nurses would receive an 18% pay increase over 3 years. Now, the MNA said the nurses will review the tentative contracts, and nurse negotiation leaders are recommending members to vote in agreement with the terms.
All right. Well, as the hospitals and union count every penny to come up with their labor agreement, the state of Minnesota is wallowing in cash. How rich is it?
Very rich. Minnesota's historic budget surplus only continues to grow, now reaching $17.6 billion, according to state projections released on Tuesday. It's a record that comes after a year of historic surplus projections. Last December, the state reported a $7.7 billion surplus, and by February, that had grown to a projected $9.2 $5 billion. The record $17.6 billion surplus comes ahead of a year when state government, now fully under DFL control, will have to set a budget of more than $50 billion for the next 2 years. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz told reporters this week that the growing surplus means the state can invest more in education, child care, and infrastructure. He also pitched, again, direct payments to residents. His fellow Democrats in the legislature, who control the House and won control of the Senate in November, have similar priorities such as paid family and medical leave, increasing education funding, and backing programs to address climate change. However, legislative leaders were not particularly receptive to Walz's proposal earlier this year to send the surplus back to Minnesota residents as rebate checks of $1,000 for individuals and $2,000 for families. There's also some disagreement on whether the state should cut income tax on Social Security payments. Walz said he was open to the idea, but legislative Democrats said they were concerned it could impact state revenue. Budget projections from the Management and Budget Department do not account for inflation, however, and this year's record inflation rates could put a dent in the actual surplus. Estimates say that inflation could cut the overall surplus by $1.5 billion. Walz, DFL House leadership, and the outgoing Republican majority in the Senate could not reach an agreement on how to use the earlier surplus before the end of the 2022 session, leaving billions of dollars on the table. Negotiations between the governor and legislative leaders on a plan to use most of the surplus in tax relief, education, and law enforcement fizzled in June, and so $7 billion of the record $9.25 billion surplus remained. But now that the DFL won control of the Senate in November, they'll have significant control over how the state uses its enormous surplus.
All right. Well, all that green aside, there has been a bit of white stuff on the ground. Will we be looking at a white Christmas this year?
Yes, for those in the Northland dreaming of a white Christmas, it's a virtual lock with several inches already in the ground, more forecast for next week, and no major melting expected. It's almost certain that much of northern Minnesota and northern Wisconsin will have a white Christmas. White Christmas is officially determined by having an inch or more of snow on the ground on December 25. But it's not just this year. Northern Minnesota is among the few regions in the contiguous United States where a white Christmas is almost guaranteed, more than 90% of the time, according to data from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Much of northern Minnesota had a white Christmas nearly 100% of the years over the last 30. You don't have to go far, though, to see those odds drop fast. Parts of southern Wisconsin and Iowa have white Christmases fewer than half of the years. In recent decades, since records have been kept at the airport, Duluth has had a brown Christmas only in 1979, when just a trace was reported on the ground. And then in 2006, when zero snow depth was reported, according to the National Weather Service. The NOAA data shows Duluth at a 92% chance of a white Christmas, while Superior, due to it being closer to the relatively warmer waters of Lake Superior, drops to just a 72% chance.
All right. Well, now I know where to place my bet on a white Christmas. A little more in Duluth than in Superior. We've been joined by Rick Lubbers, executive editor of the Duluth News Tribune. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks, Robin.
You can stay updated on these stories and the weather report and all the regional news anytime at WPR.org and DuluthNewsTribune.com. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. After hearing about the hiking adventures of Allison Young on Isle Royal, it's only fitting that we close with some of her music. And in homage to her career as a classical radio announcer, I'm sure I'm going to butcher the title. Here she is playing Carlos Guastavino's Introducción y Allegro for flute and piano, accompanied by Vicki Selvin. I'm Robin Washington. Stay safe, everyone.